Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. Welcome to class number 109 on our ongoing Siddur class on the Siddur. Today won't be so much on the Siddur unless we get into all the Nisim a little bit. We'll continue on Hanukkah. So I just want to start. I mentioned, I don't know why I couldn't remember his name. I was mispronouncing it. Just it was off the tip of my tongue. So can you see this here? Everybody see this? So this is, of course, Yehuda Rosenberg. Yehuda Rosenberg, he was the one who invented the stories of the Maharal. But that's not what, I mean, that's what he's famous for, but that's not really what he necessarily should be famous for. He was a great Talmid Chacham. He translated the Zohar into Hebrew. It is interesting from my personal perspective. He came to Canada in 1913. Where he became the spiritual leader of Toronto's Beit Jacob congregation. I only say that because I served as the rabbi of that shul for 9 years, so from 1995 onwards. So whatever, he was the founder of that shul, and of course he founded Eitz Chaim, which is one of the, I would say, one of the main day schools. When I was growing up, one of the two main day schools in Toronto. I didn't go to Eitz Chaim, but lots of people on Darcy Street, and then he moved to Montreal. And he spent many years in Montreal. And as it says here, he's perhaps most famous for stories on the Golem of Prague, which he attributed to the Marek of Prague, etc. Recent scholarship recognizes it's a work of fiction. I think he meant it as fiction. I don't think he ever meant it as real. Anyways, that's just a little bit an aside on Yehuda Rosenberg, was born, when was he born? 1860? So the stories, the Maharal died in, I believe the Maharal died in 1525 to 1609, something like that. I don't remember the exact dates, but it's many hundreds of years later. And of course, how many people have been to the shul in Prague, the Altnai shul in Prague? People been? Anybody been there? No? Yes? Okay. You can raise your hand or private to me. It's fine. But you know, they have the Altnai shul. I mentioned this last week. I think it's the most prestigious shul in Jewish history, for sure. No other shul in Jewish history. It's the shul that the Maharal was at, and the Nodiv Yehuda was, and the Tosfot Yontif was, and the list, and the Kli Yakar, the list of Gedolei Torah, giants of Jewish history who served as the rabbi of this shul in Prague is more impressive than any other shul in Jewish history. And it's not such a big shul. I don't know if people been to the shul. It's not like some of the European shuls. Because it was built in the 13th century. The shuls built in the 19th century are beautiful. You know, these European beautiful shuls, like some of the shuls in New York and Canada, North America that were built today, they don't build shuls like that anymore. I guess, unfortunately, shul was supposed to be the nicest building in the, I don't want to attack anybody, but you're not supposed to daven in a basement, in a shtibul. You're supposed to daven in a beautiful building. That's the tallest building in the shul, like the Beit HaMikdash, Hanukkah. The Beit HaMikdash was the most beautiful building, and the shul is a Mikdash Ma'ad, and they're halachas. It just wrote Jewish history. The church wouldn't allow you, the Christians wouldn't allow you to build a synagogue taller than a church. But I don't have to tell you, anybody who's traveled for sure in Europe, but even in North America, the older shuls, they are quite beautiful, quite ornate. And the Torah says, listen, the menorah was made of pure gold, lots of gold. So Yeshiva University used to be made of gold. The dome, I don't want to call it the dome on the rock, but the dome by Yeshiva University used to be gold. And they had to sell it in the Depression years. They didn't have any money, so they had to sell it to keep the university afloat. But anyways, that's just, sorry, but the Maharal was, that shul was an amazing shul, and I was there once, and I davened there on Shabbos. It was probably one of the most moving davenings I ever had. Just thinking about it was it. Did I ever mention the minhag and then about Mizmor Shir? Did I ever tell you that minhag? There's a minhag in Prague, they say Mizmor Shir Liyom HaShabbat twice. You know, in many shuls, the chazin, who davens Kabbalat Shabbos, davens in the bima, like in the middle. And then at Baruch Hu, he goes to the front, because the sort of the practice or the most appropriate way is the bima in the middle is for Kriyat HaTorah. And that's sort of elevated, and many shuls is elevated, so you can see better and hear better. The chazan is supposed to daven lower. Mimamakim kraticha Hashem. It's hard to do in our shuls, but you know, the archaeological digs, the chazan went down. Mimamakim, from the depths, I cry out to God. But the place where we read the Torah, it's not davening. and davening were two different places. And Kabbalah Shabbos, Lecha Dodi, was a 16th century invention of the mystics in Svat. You know, nobody's, who ever heard of Lecha Dodi? Rav Shlomo Alkovitz made it up. And even saying Lechuna Ranana, which is, of course, in Tehillim, but it was never said on Friday night. That just came in the 16th century, because they didn't make up the words, but they made up the concept. Lecha Dodi, they made up the words. So they often, the chazan davens from the middle, and I remember when we were in Israel as a young kid on sabbatical, they used to let, 10-year-old kids would lead Kabbalah Shabbos, because you don't need a bar mitzvah. That's why some of the more, whatever word you want to use, open, progressive minyanim, will allow a woman to daven Kabbalah Shabbos in the partition, because it's not really part of the davening. So anyways, there's a minag in Prague to say Mizmor Shir Chanukah Aliyom HaShabbat twice. Once the Chazan says it, I had read about this minag in Danny Sperber's book, Minhag Yisrael, like I knew about the minag in theory, once from, where the Chazan in the Bima, like the Chazan davening Kabbalah Shabbos, and once when he's going to daven. Why did that happen? So they have a bunch of reasons, but one of the cute reasons is they came to shul. In Europe, it's not like us. They didn't come to shul. Rav Soloveitchik complained, we have no Jews who are shomer Erev Shabbat. We have Jews who keep Shabbos, but Jews who keep Erev Shabbos are few and far between. North America. We come home in the winter, Lech Benching, I was in Montreal last week for Bar Mitzvah. Lech Benching was 352. In Montreal is northeast of Toronto. 352 was Lech Benching. So you're not going to come home at 12 o'clock, like, and get ready for Shabbos. So you come home at 2:30. And you're rushed, and you walk in late. So, they used to daven earlier. They came to shul, and there was some problem. And the golem had to go to work to save the Jewish people. So he had to be Mechal Shabbos. So, but it was still light outside. But they accepted Shabbos, but it was still light. So they said, you know what? Let's pretend that Mizmor Shir. We didn't say with any kavana. It didn't count, whatever. So we're going to say Mizmor Shir again when it's real Shabbos. So this is probably a made up thing, but I just think that's a cute thing with the golem. Okay, that it impacted, perhaps that's the reason. And Taka, when I was there on Friday, they said Mizmor Shir twice. It was really quite amazing. And there was a room there where nobody goes to, right? They say you can't go there up on top where the golem is supposedly. But no, it's good for tourist money. The non-Jews in Prague, they have it in all the stores because it brings tourism and anything that works. Okay, let's get back.
Robert Kelvin, yes. When would you say the second Mizmor?
I'm sorry?
When did they say the second Mizmor? You said they said it twice. After like, that?
No, they said no. So today in Prague, they say it. They say Kaddish, and the Chazan just moves to the front, and they say it again. I assume if this is the origin of the Minhag, it was an hour later. In other words, whenever the Golem did whatever he had to do to get rid of some anti-Semite, so they said it again. But today they don't have the Golem there. You can't see him. So they did it. So they would mamish say it back to back. It's very strange. Like if you don't know what's flying, you walk in the shul in Prague and they say they just said Mizmor Shir, the Yom HaShabbat, and they mamish say it twice in a row. It was really fascinating. I like I said, I had heard this minhag. I think Danny Sperber's other reasons what the basis of the minhag is, but I remember that's the one that of course that caught my attention. It's the cutest reason. So I had heard about the minhag, and then when I was actually there and to see it in practice, it was kind of cool. But anyways, I think I mentioned this in the past. Anybody who wants to get an aliyah, they had all the rules of the Maharal. They're printed in the shul of a piece. They didn't have a printing press. The Maharal is before the printing press. But they wrote out all the rules of the Maharal, and they're listed. And my favorite rule is that someone who's single can't get an aliyah. No aliyah for only married people. I don't know, my favorite. I just find it cute, interesting. I don't know what the word is. Today, that doesn't go over because we believe, everybody chooses the different family structures. But, the classical Jewish view is getting married. It still is the Jewish view. Getting married is the ideal. And but they didn't allow single people to have an aliyah except twice. Two aliyahs they were allowed before they got married. One was their bar mitzvah. They gave you an aliyah in your bar mitzvah. And number two, they gave you an aliyah at your ofruf. But so that's it. You're no Simchas Torah. No kids got aliyahs on Simchas Torah. I just find it's cute. When you travel, you see all the different minhagim in different places. Okay, let's get back to the Chanukah. Let's discuss the debate between the Ramban and the Rambam. We alluded to last year, I believe, why we spoke about why Chanukah is not in the Mishnah. Now, if we take a look at the Rambam, let's do that very quickly. The Rambam, when he opens up Hilchot Chanukah, which is chapter 3 in Hilchot Chanukah and Purim, the first two chapters, you mentioned many times, are Purim, and then chapters 3 and 4 are Chanukah. So the Rambam tells us, but by Sheni Kishemachu Yavan, he tells the story of Chanukah. And the question is, why does he tell the story of Chanukah? If you go back two chapters, and to Purim, he doesn't tell the story of Purim. He says, Kriyas Megillah b'zmana mitzvah d'aseh. You got to read the Megillah. And everybody knows, and the men and women, anashim, nashim, v'geirim, men, women, converts, slaves, everybody, kids, mechantim, etaktanim, even kohanim, everybody stops what they're doing to read the Megillah. So why? And he doesn't tell us on Pesach what happened. Why by Chanukah does he tell us what happened? So the answer, I mean,
we have no record of it other than
correct.
That.
Correct. So that's how Reb Soloveitchik explained. It's a little bit strange, like what they really have no record, but especially according to the Rambam. You know, why did the Rambam call his book the Mishnah Torah?
It would have everything in it. You wouldn't need anything else.
Right. You don't need any other books. You don't need any of the books. You need the it's, this is an unbelievable Rambam. It's like I've mentioned it many times. It's mind boggling.
And well, maybe, high school, excuse me, I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I mean, we have the Megillah and that gives the history for Purim.
Right, right.
Books That's of exactly. Maccabees weren't included. So
correct. That's where Soloveitchik explains. Exactly. Because according to the Rambam's own philosophy of what he wrote, the Rambam says you need two books and you save a lot of money on books. I mean, books were expensive in the time of the Rambam. They'd be handwritten. So you needed two books. You needed a Chumash, a Tanakh, and you needed a Mishnah Torah. That's why I called it Mishnah Torah, the second Torah. That's the Torah Shebichtav. I tell you everything you got to know, and don't waste your time in Talmud, all that stuff. But then you don't need any of that. Just listen to me. You don't need any sources. That's why the Rambam doesn't quote any sources. You only quote sources if the person reading the book is going to look up the sources to discuss. But the Rambam says, I tell you what you need to know. Don't worry about the sources. And the Rambam, of course, will never quote another opinion in the Shulchan Aruch. Some say this, some say that, this and that. You know, Jews, we have one Jew, nine opinions. But the Rambam, there's only one opinion. So the Rambam doesn't quote sources. He doesn't quote other opinions. It's pretty radical. It's more than radical. As I mentioned, you know, one of my teachers said, this is the most difficult of all the Rambams, all the Rav Chaims and discussing all the Karnitian Rambam. The most difficult Rambam is how could he say, what chutzpah to say that the only book you need in your library is a Tanakh and my book. But that is what he says. That is what the Rambam says. And that's why he's calling it Mishnah Torah. And therefore, Rav Soloveitchik, I was just rereading it last week. It's Mamish in Harei Kedem. I put some of the, you know, the thoughts, not that he wrote them, but the students wrote them, Rav Soloveitchik. So they have. Why does the Rambam start with Hilchot Chanukah like this? Because there's no other book. And so you're not going to know about Chanukah. It's kind of whatever. So that's what the Rambam, but that's one answer. There is a second answer. And that has to do with the Rambam is telling us that the history by Chanukah is very nice. In other words, the Rambam approves of what the Chashmonaim did. Why wouldn't he approve of the Chashmonaim? So I'm sure many of you know, I'm sure people know, the Chashmonaim were not such ayayay. Things did not work out so phenomenal. And we'll just take a quick look at the Ramban. The Ramban, who often disagrees with the Rambam, as much as he respected the Rambam, I don't know which to say first. He respected the Rambam a lot, but he totally disagrees with him, or really the other way. He sharply disagrees with him, and but yet he understood the greatness of the Rambam. So when people were burning his books, he tried to tell them, don't burn his books. You know, but they sharp disagrees. Somebody once talking to Rambam, and every major issue, the Rambam was Ramban, Nachmanides, who was born in 1194. The Rambam's born in 1138. So they're sort of, you know, and the Ramban, they never met by, the Rambam dies in 1204. So the Rambam was 10 years old when the Rambam died, and the Rambam is living in Egypt, and the Ramban is living in Spain. But it's like, you know, a generation apart. So the Ramban we'll read it in a couple of weeks in Shul, on Jacob's blessings to his children, Gur Aryeh Yehuda, that Yehuda is a lion, Let me tear up in the Alita. You're going to be above everybody. Alita, like the lion, is the king of the jungle. So Yehuda Kilavi Yekimenu. It's a very strange pasuk. Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda. The shevet, whatever that means, they don't turn the scepter, but should not depart from Yehuda. So the Ramban says that this is the verse that tells us, we'll put it in modern terms, that you have to have separation of church and state. That when, as I like to quote always Jonathan Sachs, when you mix religion and politics, you get bad politics and worse religion. Religion is clean and beautiful and holy and spiritual, and politics is dirty and muddy and compromising and not being doing what you don't believe in because you got to, you know, you can't allow aid to Ukraine because the border in Mexico is open. Manyan Shmita Leitzel Harsina. Well, I don't understand these things, but that's politics. Politics, as Rav Soloveitchik said, is kulo sheker. I haven't quoted that one for a while. Politics is kulo sheker, complete lies, falsehood. And Torah is Torah emet. So you cannot mix politics and Torah. Now, of course, the ideal Jewish way is that the politicians would keep the Torah. It's not that the separation of church and state, like the American model exactly. Obviously, you have to fund education. We're not talking like that. It's the more of the European model, where they did fund Jewish education and all the education. They still fund, all the European countries fund the Jewish schools. But the idea that the kingship is separate and the political leadership, and that's what the Rambam writes, will do it only in English. This is the reason for the punishment of the Hashmonaim who reigned during the Second Temple. So the Rambam first says how wonderful they were. They were saints of the Most High, or it's in English, it doesn't quite sound this good, but okay. Without whom the learning Torah and their observance would be forgotten. That's the point Zev made last week, that they kept the Torah alive, and that's why Hanukkah should remain a holiday. But okay, that's how the Ramban is saying it. It's not how the Rambam describes it, and not how the other sources, but fine. And despite this, they suffered great punishment. The four sons of the Yochashmoni, Matanyahu, saintly men, to rule one after another, and success fell by the sword of their enemies. And ultimately, the punishment reached a stage where out of the rabbi said, he who says, I come from the house of Hashmonaim, is a slave. They didn't have any proper Jewish descendants. They were finished, lost to the people. And they were all destroyed on account of this sin. Now, though among the children of Shimon, blah, 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 the Sadducees, okay. So he said, they were deposed for this only, for they ruled even though they were not of the seed of Judah and of the house of David, and thus they were completely removed, the septon lawgiver from Judah. And their punishment was measure for measure, as the Holy One, blessed be He, caused their slaves to rule over them who destroyed them. They wanted to rule when they was inappropriate, so people who were inappropriate to rule would rule over them. This is, again, it's an amazing Ramban, and the Ramban is very, very critical of the Hashmonaim. So I remember in high school, one of my teachers saying, Rabbi Berglass made Aliyah when I graduated high school. I guess he had enough of me. He wanted after having our class. Anyways, but so he said the Rambam, and then he quoted, the Rambam is saying that was meant as a joke, but nobody laughed. So that means it wasn't such a good joke. I'm sorry. Okay, but the Rambam is basically saying that he's approving of the history. In other words, what the Hashmonim did to take over the kingdom, which is what the Rambam says. Remember, the Rambam says, and sovereignty returned to the Jewish people for over 200 years. So the Rambam is praising the ruling of Israel. The Rambam is much more, he downplays the oil. The oil comes up only later. But the Rambam, the main reason we're celebrating Hanukkah is because Behemidu Melech Min HaKohanim. The Rambam says it black and white. They took a king from the Kohanim. He's not saying anything bad. This is what we're celebrating. The Chazra Malchut Yisrael Yetzer Matam Shana. And therefore, Jewish people had sovereignty for more than 200 years till the end of the Second Temple. Then we discussed last week. So why did it continue after the Second Temple? But the Rambam is very clear that the Kohanim, he mentions here Kohanim. He's very clear. He knows they're Kohanim. And he knows they were the ones who became the heads of the political leaders of the Jewish people. And that's the great celebration that we have. Not the oil, but that the Jews were around their own country. You had high priest running the country. So that's an amazing Rambam. The Rambam would obviously say that we had no choice. Yeah. The idea of the 12 Shvatim, that was, that's long gone. In the year 721, BCE, Sanherib came. Sanherib Bilbelet. He mixed up all the people. He did ethnic modern terms. He did ethnic cleansing. That's what's. It's sort of what whatever, we can, that comes up later with Yosef. They really, they mixed all the nations, so nobody knows who they are anymore. That's the way to weaken people. So yeah, that's what Sanherib did in the year 721, and that's why we don't have Amalek anymore. That's why, I mean, that's how, whatever, that's how the simple, whatever that means, but we don't have Ammonim and Moabim, so we don't, maybe they're an Ammoni, maybe they can't convert. We don't have any of this anymore. We don't know who anybody is. And we don't know who, and the 10 tribes are lost. They exiled into, we don't have tribes, we're the Kohanim, this and that. So I don't know. So the Rambam is no problem that the Hashmonaim became. And I guess, listen, if you want to put this in modern terms, this is, you know, yes, they weren't religious, they weren't this and that, but it's great. It's not, who cares? As long as the leaders are the Jewish people and you have sovereignty, even if it's not the right leaders. Yes, even an ideal leader, you want religious leaders, you know, that's, a, but we still have to celebrate when you have leaders who eat on Yom Kippur. If the Jewish people are running their own state, that's what the Rambam says, even sort of in sin, if you want to combine the two, or that's a wonderful thing. So anyways, there's obviously, like every holiday and everything, there's applications to our modern times. What exactly it is, you know, it's obviously, it's never easy to translate ancient events. What we learn from history is always hard. But I think it's a fascinating debate between the Rambam and the Ramban. It seems to get to the essence of what Hanukkah. The Ramban is quite critical. And I mentioned last year, it's like, it's hard to believe, but it's what they quote. Many people quote. The Chatam Sofer said that the reason Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did not include Hanukkah in the Mishnah, it's alluded to, but it's not talked about in the Mishnah. It's, well, you know, Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, it's not mentioned anywhere in the Mishnah, is because he was from Shevet Yehuda, and he felt that was inappropriate, and it was sort of his way of saying, I don't like what the Hashmonaim did, I'm not going to include them in the Mishnah. And that sounds like, I always say, that sounds like a muscle. That's the Chasam Sofer, wouldn't classify himself as a, sound like some university professor giving some, so it doesn't sound like the Chasam Sofer. But whatever it is, I read this week a very long article, but a great article. I forget now who wrote it. I should know. But 10 years ago on the Sfarim blog, which always has great articles. So the Sfarim blog, why Hanukkah is not mentioned in Mishnah. He mentions like 10 different reasons why Hanukkah is not mentioned in Mishnah. But anyways, that's one. That's they quote in the name of the Chatam Sofer because the Hashmonaim took over the Melucha and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi wasn't happy with that. So when he edited the Mishnah, he didn't include it in. No, take that as you want. Okay, I said I'd discuss it, so we're going to round up a few points on Hanukkah. Any questions, any comments?
Did the Ramban suggest an alternative? They took over the kingship, but did the Ramban suggest an alternative that would have been acceptable at the time?
So that's a great question. I don't know. I don't think he suggested there in Vayechi. In other words, I just said Sancheirib mixed up all the nations. So how do you do this? So we know that we assume that 98% of Jews are we're Yehudim. I mean, we're Yehudim. We're Shevet Yehuda. We're from Shevet Yehuda. Right, you know, maybe the Ethiopian, you know, that's, you know, who are the 10 lost tribes? And the Mishnah actually has a discussion. Will the 10 tribes ever come back? And the Mishnah in Sanhedrin quotes an opinion. They are lost permanently. They will never come back to the Jewish people. But obviously, when we say, oh, the Ethiopians are really Jewish, they're Shevet Dan or whatever they are, we are working on the assumption that maybe we will bring back in this, where there, whatever, with the return of the people to the land of Israel, maybe we will return and we will have the 10 tribes coming back. So, right. So I don't know what the alternative is. That's a very good question. It reminds me of a cute joke. I don't know. Maybe it isn't a joke. I don't know. You'll see what it is. When they asked Rav Soloveitchik, is it okay that Golda Meir is the prime minister, a woman prime minister? Because, you know, it says Melech below Malka. Som tasi Melech HaMelech. So that already is very interesting. I'm going to get into trouble now, but the Sifri, the rabbinic commentary that predates the Mishnah, it's the source of much of the Mishnayot. The Sifri is the rabbinic halachic commentary on the Pesukim, and then that gets put together into the Mishnah. Much of the Mishnah comes from there. So the Sifri on the verse says, Melech, someone appoint the king. So the Sifri says, Melech, the lo malka. You can't appoint the queen. You can't appoint the queen. So of course, Rav Cook and others are of the opinion that the prime minister of Israel, or maybe that's an interesting question, who, the prime minister or the president? I would assume it's the president, actually. But okay, we'll leave that aside. The leader of the state of Israel has the din of a melech. that the melech doesn't necessarily mean a king. And we know the Abarbanel and others were opposed to kingship. They thought kingship was bad. Like there are mitzvot in the Torah, the Torah allowed. The Torah doesn't like it. The Torah doesn't like yifat Torah, that you can rape, you can almost rape a woman in war. So it says, okay, don't rape her. Don't rape her. Do this and that. The Torah didn't think that's a great idea. The Torah allowed polygamy. The Torah didn't think polygamy is a good idea. The Torah allows things because of human nature. The Rambam goes so far to say the Torah allowed korbanot. They didn't think korbanot was a good idea either. That got him into trouble. But okay, that's what he says. So, the fact that something is in the Torah doesn't necessarily mean it's a wonderful thing. Not so, is having a king good? The Abarbanel, who of course experienced firsthand what it is to live under a king, that's why he's probably the best one to talk about it, under Ferdinand and Isabella and everything that happened. So he wrote how terrible kingship is. That was a concession. It's really much better. A democracy, as Churchill says, democracy might be the worst form of government except for all the other ones. So, and that's why many modern people thought democracy is a wonderful thing. We don't have to have a king. The Rambam disagrees. The Rambam says you need a king. But anyways, so Melech below Malka, you can't have a queen. So how can Golda Meir, that's like the state of Israel, how can Golda Meir be the prime minister? So I didn't hear it from Rav Soloveitchik, I heard it's secondhand. And so then Rav Soloveitchik said, Ben Gurion was allowed. It was okay to have Ben Gurion. Well, what are you worried about? Golda Meir, Ben Gurion, whatever. Okay, so these are, our quips, but they say something. When you don't have a choice, you take whoever. So Ben Gurion was great. He was the one I mentioned when reading. So I went to when I was in high school. So Rev Tabori, our Rosh Yeshiva, spent many years, of course, in Yeshiva at Harachon. I'm sure many people know him there. Binyamin Tabori, who passed away, unfortunately, a number of years ago. My Rosh Yeshiva in Toronto, in Archaim, when I was in high school, I remember him telling us very distinctly, how we meaning the modern Orthodox, the religious Zionist world, where we struggle with Herzl. The secular Zionist Herzl is the biggest hero in the world. Since Moshe Rabbeinu, they have nobody greater than Herzl. Herzl returned the Jewish people. Unbelievable. Without Herzl, there'd be no state of Israel. He was the greatest person who ever lived in the last 2,000 years. The Haredim think he's a apikoiris and an oisvorp, and he ate on Yom Kippur and the this and that and all the terrible things. He wanted to uproot Torah, the worst guy in the world. And we think they're both right, or they're both wrong. We have to figure out exactly, it's a little bit of both. So yes, we look to the greatness. So that's what it means to be a modern Orthodox Jew. You struggle with all these issues. So, so what do you do? So the Rambam is taking the pro Herzl view that, the Rambam knows the verse in Vayechi. He knows. And the Rambam is the one who says you have to have a king. The other people are not so into having a king. The Rambam is the most one having a king. The king, Malchut Beit David, that's what you need. That's it. We're going to come back. We're going to get that. And yet the Rambam says, beautiful. We had no choice. We had no choice. We're going to celebrate that these terrible, the people who came terrible, who became slaves, all the terrible things that happened from them. They were the leaders of the Jewish people. Beautiful. We have a Jewish day we're going to celebrate for 235 years. And I don't know what the Rambam says. What did he expect to happen? That's a good question. Maybe the rabbis who are like the, I don't know. I don't know. I have to look more. Thank you. I really don't know. Okay. Anybody else? Anything else? Okay. Let's move on to Sukkos. Sukkos and Hanukkah. So I'm sure people, anybody follow Beit Shammai? There is this idea. I don't know what it means, but we'll follow Beit Shammai in the Messianic era. That, Rav Zevin has a beautiful article on what unites the arguments between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Why do they disagree so much? The 318 arguments, I believe, between Beit Hillel. Hillel and Shammai only argue three times. The only three arguments between Hillel and Shammai. They're quoted in the Mishnah's Edius. If you look up the first Mishnah, that was the original Mishnah Ediyot. We've spoken about that in the past. The Mishnah that gives all the testimonies. They came to Yavneh, temple's destroyed, Tein li Yavneh v'chach. And the rabbi, I remember this lie, remember that lie. There, it's a potpourri. It's all over the place because they're giving testimony. It's not one unit. That's the first Mishnah. And there in the first Mishnah, the first chapter, it lists off the three arguments between Shammai and Hillel. But that's Shammai and Hillel. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, that's a totally different story. Rev Zevin has a great article. Well, what are they arguing about? It's that, and that's, it's about Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai that the Talmud says, Elu ve'elu, Divir Elohim Chaim. These and those are the words of the living God. V'halacha ki Beit Hillel. We have to follow and practice Beit Hillel. We have to light candles 1 to 8. But lighting candles from 8 to 1 also makes sense. Also makes sense to light candles from 8 to 1, but we can't do both. I mean, I guess you could. Some people, you know, have in this part of the house, you like 1 to 8. In this house, you like 8 to 1. But no, that's a little bit insane. Okay, so why does Beit Shammai say you go 8 to 1?
Because the miracle got less and less every day. It didn't have to last that much longer.
That's sort of one of the answers the Gemara said. That's Rav Zevin talks about that as an overarching theme, the difference between actual and potential. Beit Shammai always looks at the potential, and Beit Hillel looks at the actual. So on the first night, there are potentially 8 days of the miracle left, whatever. So Aiden and Beit Hillel says only one, so the actual potential, correct. Although the Gemara doesn't, the Gemara says, Kineged Yamim Hanich Nasim, Yamim Hayotzim. That's, I don't know if it's exactly the same. The day's coming in and the day's leaving. That's one reason. But the reason that ties into in Sukkot, that's the reason I want. What's the second reason?
Based on the Sukkot model of Korbanot.
You know, right, it's based on the Sukkot model of
number of Korbanot from 13 down.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a real head scratcher. Let's just take a quick look at the Talmud. Masechet Shabbat, while it's not mentioned in the Mishnah, it's mentioned briefly in the Gemara in the context of lighting Shabbos candles, right? The Shabbos candles and Hanukkah candles, they're very different. Shabbos candles, you derive benefit from. Hanukkah candles, you're not allowed to derive benefit. They serve totally different purposes. Shabbos candles and Hanukkah candles. So here's a famous passage in the Mishnah, famous. Tana Rabbana, Mitzvot Hanukkah, Neru Shabbat. Good enough, one candle. Don't give me this. Everybody lights one candle all 8 nights. That's it. Every household has one candle. Mahadrin. This it came up a little bit in our Yom Yun last week on Hanukkah. Those who beautify Hadar, those who beautify Mitzvot, Ner L'chol Achad V'Achad. 5 people in the house, 5 candles the first night, the second night, the 8th night. 5, 5, 5, 5. Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin. Those are the beauty of the beautiful. We have to discuss why on Hanukkah is there a Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin. We have this by no other mitzvah. Beit Shammai Yomrim, Yomri Shomad Lishmona, on the first day you light 8, Mikamelech Pochet Volech, you go down. Beit Hillel says, you go up, Mosif Volech. Amar Ula. So Ula is living, 250 years later. So he's quoting an earlier tradition. He says, two Amoraim, that's also quite after Beit Hillel. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai is the first generation of Tanaim. There's 6 generations of Tanaim. It's probably more than 250 years later. So Amoraim, which begins after the Mishnah, so we're at least 6 generations later. Rav Yossi Bar Avin and Rav Yossi Bar Zvida, one says, Tamai, it's very interesting. There are 8 more days coming, so we're going to light 8 candles. But Tamai Beit Hillel, no, how many days have happened? So you can say that's actual and potential miracle, however you want to interpret. The Chanamar, and one of them says, apparently we don't know which one said which. Tamai Beit Shammai, Kineged Parei HaChag. The reason of Beit Shammai is because of the bulls, the cows they brought on Sukkot, the Tamai Beit Hillel, the famous reason, Malim Bekodesh Ve'Moridim. So you read Beit Shammai, what do you mean, Kineged Parei HaChag? So we know that on Sukkot, it says in the Torah that we bring 70 bulls, 70 parim, because we like the 70 nations of the world. We're going to pray for the 70 nations of the world. So what do? You bring 10 every day. There's 7 days of Sukkot. On Shemini Atzeret, it's different. Korbanot are different. So you bring 10 every day and finished. That's not what the Torah says. It goes 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7. So great. So because on Sukkot, we go 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7. So on Hanukkah, I have to figure out I'm going to light 8 candles, one candle. You know what? So I better go. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. What is it with the price of tea in China? Ma'inyan Shemitah, Leitzel Har Sinai. What in the world is Beit Shammai talking about? It makes absolutely no sense.
The fact that Hanukkah, I once heard Hanukkah is 8 days, is based on the fact of Sukkot, because they couldn't keep Sukkot that year.
Right, so that's what it says in the Book of Maccabees. The book, it doesn't say this about lighting candles, because the Book of Maccabees doesn't know from candles. I mentioned last week, somebody asked me on on Josephus. I did check. He does not mention the oil. We discussed this last week. The oil comes up later. It's not mentioned in the Book of Maccabees or Josephus or even in Al Nisim. It's not mentioned. But in the Book of Maccabees, it says they celebrated Sukkot for 8 days, Chanukah for 8 days, because they didn't celebrate Sukkot that year for 8 days. Let me ask you a question. Did they celebrate Pesach that year? Or Shavuos? Maybe Chanukah should be 18 days. 8 days for Sukkot and 16. I don't know. They're living in Israel. 7 days for Pesach is 15, and 1 day for Shavuot. And you know what? They didn't celebrate for 3 years. Let's make it 51 days. Be nice. Chanukah candles. You know how many gifts people have to give 51 days of? You only Sukkot you eat the 51 days of Chanukah? Well, I don't understand. It's very nice. Okay, so it's the closest one to Sukkot. Sukkot was just 2 months earlier. As far as I know, it was 3 years the Greeks were in charge. So they didn't celebrate Pesach either. And very nice. They didn't celebrate Sukkot, so we're going to make Chanukah into Sukkot. You know what? We have a principle: Avar Yomo Batal Korbano. The day you missed it, you missed it. You didn't have a Seder this year. You couldn't have a Seder. Nunu, so you didn't have a Seder. You're in the army and you're fighting on Yom Kippur and you can't fast. So you don't fast a week later because I didn't fast on Yom Kippur. You missed Yom Kippur that year. That's it. That's what you have to do. Torah says, sometimes you don't fast on Yom Kippur. Torah says, so you, honest Rachmana Patre, when we have no choice, we're anus. We are, what's the word? Forced. We are coerced to do something. We're not held liable if we are coerced to do something. That's a very fundamental principle in Jewish law, honest Rachmana Patre, that if somebody holds a gun to your head, even somebody who bows down to idols because somebody holds a gun to his head. So it's a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem, the mitzvah to sanctify God, to give up your life. But if you don't, the guy, he's weak. Like, he doesn't want to give up his life. You can't judge him. You can't blame him. He bows down to idolatry. He doesn't mean it. He bows down. It doesn't mean it. He didn't do idolatry. We don't consider him an idolater. We consider him one who didn't do Kiddush Hashem. It's not idolatry. God holds a gun to your head and says, well, that's meaningless. That's why it's, by the way, that's why important religious coercion, the mitzvot are meaningless. If you force somebody to do a mitzvah, the mitzvah has no meaning. People have to do mitzvah of choice. Where do you draw that line? You want to educate people, but forcing someone to do a mitzvah, the mitzvah loses all meaning.
Rabbi Jay.
Yes.
But I think that presupposes the teachings of the rabbis, and they didn't have the teachings of the rabbis.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. I'm just throwing that in. So,
but the issue I think is that their focus was on what was going wrong with the temple. And Sukkot is the regel par excellence at the temple.
Excellent.
And this is what their focus was. So that's why they decided that this is what they should do. So it was Sukkot in Tevet.
Yes, that's 100%. Clearly, what they're saying is that Sukkot and Chanukah are thematically connected. Obviously, they are thematically connected. So let's just go through some of the themes. So as Steve says, the main theme is their temple holidays. First of all, the first temple was dedicated by Shlomo HaMelech on Sukkot. So right away, Sukkot gets a very temple feel. There are more korbana brought on Sukkot than any other holiday. The notion of hidur, beautifying a mitzvah, right? Hidur, mehadrin mina mahadi, hidur mitzvah is by the Beit HaMikdash. That's where you have the whole concept. Sukkot is the temple holiday par excellence. And Chanukah, obviously, is the temple holiday. So the rabbis are linking Chanukah and Sukkot. Clearly, it's not stum because they didn't celebrate Pesach either. It's not that they're really making it up. They're having like, okay, we missed Sukkot. So let's make Chanukah Sukkot. It's the same idea. It's almost the same idea. As good. Not exactly, of course. Now, it's very interesting, where I've mentioned this in other classes. Where does the Gemara talk about the laws of Hallel? It's good. Why I review. That's why I like review. Okay. Where does the Gemara talk about Hallel? Masechet Sukkah, the third paragraph. The third parak in Masechet Sukkah, Lulav Hagazel, the guy who steals a lulav, that's how the chapter starts. You don't fulfill mitzvah, baba, avira. And that's where all the laws of Hallel are mentioned in Sukkot. And we know, the only We say Sukkot, we say Hallel all 8 days of Sukkot. We only say Hallel one day on Pesach. Half Hallel doesn't really count. That's a later custom. But Hallel is only said one day on Pesach and Chanukah later. So Hallel, there's no Chanukah in the Mishnah. So the laws of Hallel are mentioned in Sukkot. Now, interestingly, and of course you should know the answer, where does the Rambam talk about the laws of Hallel? It's like in Hilchot Chanukah. Where else? Right? He should talk about it in Hilchot Sukkah, but of course the Rambam doesn't do that. And you'll notice something fascinating. The Rambam, he says the whole story, and then in Halachah 3, the rabbis made 8 days. You may simcha v'halel, and you light the candles, you know, for 8 days to publicize the miracle, you know, fast. And then the Rambam says, like, okay, if you have to hear the Megillah, you have to light Hanukkah candles. And then the Rambam gets started. On all these 8 days, you say the whole Hallel. Gomrim et Hallel means you say full Hallel. Right? Well, if we have time, we'll get to that. How do you say Bitzivanu on a rabbinic mitzvah? The Gmor et Hallel doesn't matter, even though it's only a rabbinic mitzvah. Mitzvah midivrei sofrim. Mivarech Aleha, you can still make the blessing. Even though God never commanded us. The same way, make a bracha on all rabbinic mitzvot, which he doesn't explain. The Gemara will explain later. He just means that's what we always do. We always explain. And then the Rambam spends 10 halachas about going through Hallel. The Rambam talks how you say Hallel. Do 21 days or 18 days. All the days of the year we say Hallel. Now, all of Hallel is put in Hilchot Chanukah. And then when we say half Hallel, what do we skip? And you can say Hallel all day, not just in the morning. We say it in the morning, but you can theoretically say it all day. You're in a hurry in the morning. And it goes through over and over. The whole parak is about Hallel. And, you know, he keeps going about Hallel. And there used to be, the chazan would say, you'd answer after him responsibly. You'd answer, I mean, all through the laws of Hallel. It's a long, there are only two chapters in Hilchot Chanukah. And most of the time, the Rambam spends talking on Hallel. An Hashem Hoshiana. And you answer, Ana Hashem Oshiana. Okay, and he says, Ana Hashem Atzlichana, and you answer. Okay, and the Rambam starts. And then the Rambam says, you know what else we do on Chanukah? We light candles. Come and they wrote the guys. I found that really fascinating. The Rambam discusses all of Hallel before he gets into lighting candles. Hallel is more important than lighting candles. We discussed last week, the Gemara in Shabbat, that Chanukah was established, the Hallel v'Hoda'ah. Right? My Chanukah, remember we discussed that last week. Why? And Rashi says it doesn't mean what's Chanukah, it means why do we celebrate Chanukah? And Mara goes through the whole story. And then it says, Leficha b'shleshana acheret, in another year, sometime in the future, they made it the Behalel, Behoda'ah, and Halel is Halel, and Behoda'ah is Al Hanisim. Doesn't say anything about lighting candles. I mean, and we light the candles, but the focus of the mitzvah is Halel and Behoda'ah. So the Rambam, obviously, what's the Rambam doing? The Rambam is linking Chanukah and Purim in his genius way that the Rambam, you know, codifies the laws. Like he redoes everything. See, what's so tragic about what the Rambam says that you only need his book? If you only had his book, you wouldn't understand how brilliant the Rambam is. It's only when you see the sources of the Rambam, you realize how brilliant the Rambam is. Because the Rambam will collate 7 different sources and put it in a seamless sentence. And that's why there's so many commentaries on the Rambam, untangling where the Rambam gets it. Because he often, literally, he's often quoting from 4 sources in one law. And he just melds them together so beautifully. So if you don't know that, if you don't learn Mishnah, because the Rambam says you don't have to, so you wouldn't know that Hallel is in Sukkah, in Masechet Sukkah. So you wouldn't see the brilliance, what the Rambam's doing. He's taking what the Gemara put in Hilchot Sukkah, and he's taking it into Hilchot Chanukah. And that's just because the Rambam obviously understood that Chanukah and Sukkot go together, even though he doesn't mention one word on Sukkot. So that's, and of course we said, right, the Book of Maccabees, the Heter Mitzvah, the Temple is dedicated. And I'll just say one last thing, and this is very beautiful. What does the Rambam also write about Chanukah? So the Rambam says towards the end of chapter 4, let's go, if I can find it, why doesn't it go? So the third chapter is basically Hallel, and the fourth chapter is basically how to light the candles. And then the Rambam, and if you're a guest, here, I love this Rambam. Mitzvah ner Chanukah, mitzvah chaviva hi la'ad mo'ad. It's a very beloved mitzvah. That's what I call this class, the most beloved mitzvah. Mitzvah Ner Chanukah, mitzvah chaviva hi at lema'od. Wow, we love it. It's so beautiful. Everybody loves Chanukah. It's your favorite holiday, right? Mitzvah chaviva hi mo'od. It's sarich adam lisaherba. You have to be very careful with it. It's so beloved. Kidei lo dianes, to let everybody know all the wonderful things that happened, that the Ubez Manazeh, as we spoke last week, miracles throughout Jewish history. We're going to light the candle in exile. God has not forsaken us. We're coming back to the land of Israel. And to add praise, Ha'ev hodea ala nisim, afilo ein lo mayachal alamin atstaka, very sad law, an amazing law. Even if you're a welfare case, you have no money, you're living on the street, you're homeless, almost. Right? If homeless, then the question is, where do you light the Chanukah candles? Okay, that's not for now. You have to sell the clothes off your back in order to light the Chanukah candle. It's a very beloved mitzvah. And of course, Sukkot is man simchatenu, is also beloved. The Rambam talks, simcha. So even that aspect of the joy of the mitzvot, Chanukah and Sukkot seem to be the two most joyous mitzvah. But all this is very nice. All this is very nice. Now we're going to give what it all means, what I think. You'll tell me if you like this or not. Maybe you have another reason. What's the philosophical? Why? What's the deep? What's that? I can prove to you Chanukah and Sukkot are connected, but why are they connected? So they're temple holidays. Great. But what's the meaning? So I thought, and this is you tell me what you think. Sukkot is a universal holiday. Ufrosaleo Sukkot Shlomecha, the Sukkah, a piece that's universal. We bring 70 sacrifices. Because there's 70 nations of the world. We leave our home. We expose ourselves to the world out there, right? Symbolically, when you leave the house in Sukkot, no, you're exposed to the element. You're exposed to the world at large. Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah are intensely personal Jewish holidays. And Sukkot, as the Rav Soloveitchik says, the Machdir of Yonah, we begin to transition from looking inward to looking outward. Yonah is going to a non-Jewish place, to Nineveh. And that's the transition from this 40 intense days, beginning on Rosh Chodesh Elul, where we're focused inwards, what we have to do, to now we have to go out into the world and make the world a much better place. And that begins with Yonah, and that continues through Sukkot, the 70 korbanot that we bring on behalf of the nations of the world, because Sukkot is a very universal open holiday. And Chanukah is the exact opposite. Chanukah is the holiday where we reject the Greek influences. It's a holiday of rejection. Of we ghettoize ourselves, and even though we try to bring light to the world, it's really and I'm sure you know many know that historically. I told you this story last week about the professor who wouldn't celebrate Chanukah. The wrong side won. I'm on the side of the Greeks. Progress, art, architecture, philosophy, democracy. I'm on the side of the Greeks, and yet the Maccabees are going to war. Not necessarily against all these ideas, but against, many of the ideas. So I think that Chanukah and Purim have to come together, because the challenge, and this has been true for the last 200 years especially, it's always true, but much more, it wasn't so true in Poland. In 16th century Poland, this wasn't so true. The main question facing the Jewish people is the balance between our accommodation with the outside world and our rejection. How much we're ger and toshav, as Rav Soloveitchik used to say. We're strangers and residents in the world. That comes from Avram when he by Maharada Machpelah. So how much are we on Chanukah, we're a ger, on Sukkot, we're a toshav? And that's been the question that's impacted Jewish history for the last 250 years, which is why Chanukah is perhaps the most important Jewish holiday today. We all know, people, what's Chanukah? The Jewish Christmas. We spoke about that last week a little bit, right? And we give gifts. I don't think that giving gifts is a Jewish, nothing wrong necessarily. I mean, we march down the aisle, at a wedding. The parents march down with the kids. Very beautiful. It's not a Jewish custom. In Israel, they sometimes do. They march the chat like we do at the bedecking. They do at the chuppah. I don't know if they still do that in Israel. They march the chat and kala to the chuppah. The parents don't march down. The ceremony, the flower girl, and this and that. Everybody laughs and smiles. Very cute. Very, very beautiful. I think it's beautiful to march your child down the wedding, but that's not a Jewish custom. And we take many non-Jewish customs. That's a question. Which non-Jewish customs are allowed and which aren't allowed? Some are deeply prohibited. There's a verse in the Torah, you're not allowed to follow the Chukan HaGoyim. That's Dr. Revel in 1932. Dr. Revel in 1932 wrote a tshuva. Yeshiva College is founded in 1928. Your first graduation in 1932. Ooh, Can you wear your black hat, your robe, and your tassel? You know, the whole graduation ceremony. Isn't that chukka de goyim? No, is it?
Well, actually, isn't there a and source?
With, they don't have a ceremony. And even in Wayu Smicha, they don't do that. You don't mark down with your gowns for Wayu Smicha. But at Yeshiva College, you do. At Stern College, you do. Yes, Yocheben.
Oh, isn't the source for Hanukkah gelt because one would give the Rebbe money and so the child shouldn't feel bad? Yeah, I heard this, that it's, you know, you give
when they underpaid the Rebbeim, like when they didn't pay Rebbeim enough, so they had to give him a few dollars of Hanukkah. So that's very
what they did was they would give the child would bring the money
By the way, it's the same custom. You pay the rabbi when he sells your chametz and he does a funeral. Right. So I think that's a tragic custom. And there are certain shuls the rabbi refuses to take money, as he should. But that can only work if you pay the rabbi a living salary. Yeah, when they underpay the rabbi, they pay him babkas. So he has to, and you have shuls, Ada Yom HaZeh will say, we pay you less, but you know, you're going to make $10,000 on selling chametz and $5,000 for doing weddings and funerals. I don't know. There's something wrong with that. Pay a rabbi a salary that he can live on or whatever, and whatever. It's the snoring I don't like, but that's me. But okay, maybe I could be very well. I don't know.
From right. These so one gave the children geld so that they shouldn't feel like.
They shouldn't feel like. Yeah, it's nice to give presents.
You know, they're not getting anything. That kind of awesome.
Yeah, I'm not even. I'm saying there's some customs that going to do very well. So that's what Dr. Revel on he said. No, it's a beautiful custom. You want to show honor to graduates. That's very beautiful. And he based it on a Ramah. The Ramah, Ramoshe Isserlis, the chief Ashkenazic authority in the Shulchan Aruch, writes that a Jewish doctor, it's interesting, can wear a white lab coat. They had them back in the 16th century, apparently, in Poland, that Jewish doctor wore a white lab. That's an honor. It's a Goyish custom. The Goyim came up with it. It's okay. It's Chukan of Goyim you're not allowed to come up with. But that's basically, I think, the link, it's my interpretation, the link between Hanukkah and Sukkot is the balance between rejection and openness. And that since emancipation and enlightenment, that's the number one question we've been dealing with. And I always like to say, I don't know if you've heard me say it before, and even if you did, who remembers? So I don't remember. So, it's what I find fascinating is the Haredi and the Reform community both agreed what the issue is. They're just, the solution is different. Both Reform and what today is known as Haredi Judaism, whatever you want to call it, the rejection that you can all reject, whatever word you want to use, both assume that traditional Judaism and modernity cannot exist side by side. That's their assumption. Reform Judaism says you can no longer be a fully functioning Jew and live in Germany and France. You got to give up the second day yontif if we take off enough days for work. You got to be able to eat with your non-Jewish neighbors. We're going to focus on the ethics. They cannot coexist. The Torah works in the shtetl, in the ghetto, but it doesn't work in the modern world. We're going to reform Judaism. And the Chatam Sofer and his students, so to speak, or even before him said, you're right. Judaism and modernity cannot coexist. You're correct. Reform is correct. They cannot coexist. And therefore, we're going to build walls and we're not going to allow computers and television and we're going to ghettoize ourselves and we're not going to go to university and we're not going to do the et cetera, because we cannot. It's too dangerous. If we send our boys to the army, they'll get messed up. And if we participate in the Israeli economy, it won't be good. And so we have to separate ourselves because modernity, a modern state cannot exist with traditional Judaism. And it took Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, and Rav Soloveitchik and others and Rav Cook, and this is the world I live in, of course, that no, we have our cake and eat it too. The Torah is, I remember Dr. Lam saying, what if you think the Torah can only exist? I mean, he called it living in a cave. I mean, if Torah can't live in the real world, wow, that's a pretty weak Torah. It's hard. And you're going to have more quote unquote casualties. Absolutely. More people will not be able to do it because it's a riskier road and the Haredi world is not willing to take that risk. And the modern Orthodox world says we must take that risk because that's what Torah is all about, to apply Torah in the world, to make a difference in the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community. So this is why I know I sound like a rabbi now sermonized. I don't mean to say that. I mean, maybe I do a little, but I think that's what Hanukkah is all about. And But it's not all rejectionism. And much of Greek culture we do love. And the Rambam, who more than the Rambam loves Greek ideas? And yet, at the same time, we have to, at Sukkot, we can't be too open. We can't be too open because it's a problem. And that's what Hanukkah is all about. And the fact that it's at Christmas time just, you know, makes it harder. And, you know, non-observant Jews. So I think if it takes Christmas to get them to observe Hanukkah, Baruch Hashem, I don't care what, you know, I mean, at least let them have, fine. We want a Jewish Christmas. It's not good, but it's not as terrible as it sounds either. They're going to do it not by having Christmas tree. You know, in the last Pew report, when was it? 2015, 16, you know, the Pew is the gold standard in surveys. So in the last Pew report, which just happened here, I lost my comments. I don't know why. Something weird happened here. So in the last Pew report, it said that the more Jews have Christmas trees than are members in synagogues. I don't know when it came out, about 30% of the American Jews belong to synagogues. They always say, how many people Hanukkah time, I mean, on Yom Kippur, no more than 30% of Jews in Toronto, and it's less, are in the shul on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, whenever you go to shul, and about 32% own a Christmas tree. So that's a very sad number, but whatever. That's, you know, but anyways, that's the danger of course, of the openness, and that's why people say we don't want to take that risk. This society is too dangerous. Anyways, that's what Hanukkah is all about, but okay, let's just,
Can I ask you something?
Absolutely. And I apologize, I didn't let you tell your story on Herzl last week. I haven't forgotten. One day you'll let Herzl in the menorah.
It's fine. Okay. If it's to get us in our identity and inward as opposed to Sukkot, which was universal, then why are we lighting candles in the window to the Goyim?
So it's both, right? So right. So it is true. I mean, because even our rejectionism is not complete. So we want to give light to the Goyim. I mean, even our embrace is not complete within each holiday. But Hanukkah focuses more on rejection. But I once heard, I remember hearing in yeshiva, we used to light outside because we thought we could influence the world. But now the world is so corrupt and so terrible, so we have to bring the menorah inside. Now we don't really light for the outside. It's symbolically, right? Right. We know that's why we can light late at night. We don't have to light it, you know, when people are passing by anymore. And that's fine because originally you weren't allowed to light. If you missed the lighting by 5:15 when people were home, the rug lighted Tarmudai, as the Gemara says, the last people left the marketplace. Remember, people didn't go out at night. So if you missed that, like 5:30, you couldn't light candles anymore. That's it. Finished. And today you come home from a wedding at 1 a.m. You know, people get married on Hanukkah. When do you light candles? That's always a good question. So you come home at 1 a.m. You light candles. Who's going to see it? You'll see it. Your husband, your wife, your kids will see it. Beautiful. Because we're not lighting for the outside anymore. It changed. Hanukkah, I don't know that I like that interpretation so much. It changed. I mean, it did change because of Mitnei Hasakana. The Goyim were persecuting us. That's what the Gemara says. And in Israel, many people do light outside. Of course, here you have the other problem in the winter. Okay, so you've got to get a special block, but very few people in North America light outside. It's unheard of. I don't know if it's unheard of, but people don't buy those boxes that they have in Israel to light outside. Everybody lights by the window here. So I know in exile, in Israel it's different than here. But anyways, but yeah.
So, but I mean, just even we don't put our Shabbos candles by the window. Right, clearly, you want to announce it.
Right, for sure. The Hanukkah candles is to show the light the Jewish people have survived. We have to publicize the miracle, but we're publicizing a Jewish miracle. We're publicizing a God who protected Jews. We have Jews. But yes, I do think there is, of course, an element. We're publicizing to non-Jews also a little bit. But it's because we're publicizing, we're different, we're distinct, and we're still around. I don't know. This is already a little homiletic, I agree. But I'm saying, but the Hanukkah and Purim and Hanukkah and Sukkot are connected. It's clear through all our sources. But Shammai makes no sense otherwise, the whole thing. But I'm just saying, I think it has more to that. I think there's a philosophical that in many ways, Hanukkah and Sukkot are intention. Everything's intention with each other. And Sukkot more focused on universal universalism, and Hanukkah more focuses on particularism. But I just want to end with one other comment, because as we go, we have to wait. Like, we have a leap year this year, so it's going to be an extra 19 days till we get to Hanukkah next year. But very interesting, just on the laning. We can talk why Yosef. We always read about Yosef. So I wrote about that last week. A coincidence, whatever it is. But I was just thinking, the laning, Yosef is disunity with the brothers, which is our big problem. What do we lane on Hanukkah? What's the laning on Hanukkah? The 12 tribe, boring. The exact same over at everybody else. Why did Torah say over and over and over again? They brought this gift, the exact same gift. And the 12 days cut to show there was no one up in ship. Everybody participated together. It's the unity. Parsha Nasu, because the Beit HaMikdash needs unity. Otherwise, Sina Chinim were destroyed. So we read the Torah reading about Yosef. This is all, of course, an added layer. That's not the courts. This is just the way our customs work out, that we read about Yosef, the disunity of the Jewish people. But then we lane on Hanukkah, the unity of the Jewish people. So that's always a very important message. Yeah, and we want unity with the world too. For us, we pray for the world. How do we balance that? That's the issue we've been struggling with throughout our entire history, and especially in the modern age. Okay, just to quickly review. Yehuda Rosenberg, fine. We went over him. The Mara, very nice. And how people daven and why they say Mizmor Shir twice in Prague. This Minag maybe, I don't know if it's really, because of the story of the Golem. Kabbalah Shabbos is really an add-on. Then we discussed the Ramban and the Ramban. There are different attitudes apparently towards Hanukkah. The Ramban says, yeah, the Chashmonim did great things, but they blew it. They blew it because they took over the political leadership, and that's a terrible thing. Religion and politics. Yehuda, Shevet Yehuda, and the Kohanim separate. Religion is pure. Politics, it's messy. They cannot mix. Keep separate. Obviously, we want our political leaders to be religious. And the Rambam seems to not be bothered by that. He seems to say, yeah, they were Kohanim. And that's okay, but they brought back the kingdom, kingship or sovereignty of the Jewish people. That's a wonderful thing worth to celebrate. And then we discussed the link between Hanukkah and Sukkot, primarily Beis Shammai's view that we liked Sukkot, but why not for Pesach? And we discussed how the link between the Beit HaMikdash and Sukkot, and the Sukkot and Hanukkah, and why the Rambam puts Hallel Hilchot Hanukkah, which in the Gemara is in Sukkah, into Hanukkah, but they're both dedication mitzvah, they're both of Hidur mitzvah, to beautify the mitzvah. We didn't really get to discuss why we have Mahadrin and Mahadrin and Mahadrin. We'll have to leave that, please God, for next year, for another time, but okay, let me just see if there are any quick questions here. Beautiful and interesting, but problematic for women. Yeah. Oh, yes. I assume you're talking to Shul in Prague. Yes, it is very problematic for women. They didn't have a women's, section. They added one in modern times, but it's they dug into the wall. If you've been to the Shul in Prague, they made like a hole, like 1 by 2 feet, in the 4 different places, something, so you can kind of look in. It's a big stone, thick stone. And they, because women went to Shul in the 1200s. I'm not joking. That's right. We live in a different society. I told you Mark Shapiro's story. He was in Tunisia, and the shul had no mechitza. They have 12 shuls in Tunisia. So he went to the rabbi. He said, "Where's the mechitza?" So the rabbi looked at him in the eye. Said, "Ma in yanashim etz beit knesset. Do you know a woman ever go to shul? I never met a woman who goes to shul. What about a woman after going to shul? It's a different culture. It's a totally different culture. In our culture, it should be the three day age rites. You have to have a mechitza. You should walk into shul." And he doesn't write exactly this, but today would be this. You don't know what side is the woman's side and what side is the man's side. The mechitza woman should be, it's a very different society, and halacha has to adjust within its bounds. Obviously, mechitzas are very different than they once used to be. Yes, okay. How about Shlomsi and Hamalka? Yeah, I don't know enough about it, right? But there were women people. Yes, and Dvorah was a Neviyah, but that's a Shopetet, and that was allowed. And when, okay, you're right. We had, but the Sivri says, when you have an actual melech, it should be a melech, but sometimes we did not do that. Sometimes you don't have a choice. Can you point to a link? I don't have a link to the article that Rabbi Yonassi omitted evidence from the Mishnah. I'm not, I just know this from various sources. I'm not aware of one article, but if I do come across, I'll look for one. I will pass it along. Okay, I want to wish everybody Hanukkah Sameach. We still have a few hours left. Zot Hanukkah. Enjoy. Shabbat Shalom. We should hear good news, the light, which bring peace. The Rambam, I didn't do that part today, that the Shabbos candles are for peace, and therefore they're more important than the Hanukkah candles when you only have one. So that we should be blessed with peace, as we need especially now. So we should hear good things. Okay. Rabbi. Shabbat Shalom. Hanukkah Sameach. Yes, I have to run and teach, so I'm sorry.
Shabbat Shalom.
quick.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Okay.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. Email Shabbat me any shalom. Questions or please go out next week. We can, Okay. Thank you very much. Shabbat Shalom. Bye bye.
Thank you.